Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, international editor at Reaction. The coronavirus pandemic has put Western security under the spotlight. An assertive China and a resurgent Russia pose strategic dilemmas for governments and policymakers. And the value of the NATO alliance forged in the depths of the Cold War has been called into question. So, is it time for liberal democracies to review their strategic options? And can NATO be updated to meet the challenges of modern geopolitics? With me to discuss these issues on the podcast today are Karen von Hippel, Director General of the Royal United Services Institute, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor at the Evening Standard. So, Karen, is the NATO Security Alliance fit for the 21st century?
I guess I would start out before plunging directly into NATO to say that we are at a crucial point, as you started out with in your introduction, and the world could go in several different directions, and some of it will depend on the results of the U.S. election in November. So, because I think that the U.S., if we have four more years of Trump, we're going to see further atomization, fragmentation, nationalism, and states going it alone. If Biden wins, we're going to have at least an attempt to return to multilateralism and partnering with other countries. I think the one thing we've learned from this pandemic is none of us can do any of this on our own. We have to work together. And that would apply to NATO as much as any other alliance or institution. And I think, you know, the positive thing about NATO is it's endured a lot. It's been with us for many decades now. And as much as Trump may disdain it, the vast majority of Americans in Congress and probably the public appreciate what NATO does. And so I think if we do have four more years of Trump, he will try to undermine it, I suspect. But I suspect also that the institutions in Congress and elsewhere will push back very hard. So, you know, this is a very long answer, I apologize, but I think NATO is an incredibly important alliance. It can do a lot. I think that some of the challenges related to building greater resiliency to fight future global crises of this kind, some of it can be done at NATO. So we can talk about that a bit more, I think, later.
Robert, is there a sense that after 4 years of a Trump presidency, NATO is in bad need of some love and it does need to be renewed? And what should its guiding purpose be moving onwards from the pandemic?
It should think the changing context. As Karen said, things are moving so fast. There are the old elements. There are blocks that need to share and pool sovereignty, of course, embraced in the founding Article 5. I absolutely follow what Karen said about the Trump presidency, because the Trump presidency is the emblem of a phenomenon that all multinational organisms, treaties, and strategic concepts has to confront. And it's the politics of narcissism. There are so many narcissistic leaders now right across the board, not only Trump, but Putin, even Xi Jinping to an extent. Another glaring example is President Erdogan of Turkey, and not to say our own dear leadership here in Europe, our own country, UK, Macron in France, because the point about narcissistic leadership is it's self-reflexive. It ignores so much for boosting itself. And I absolutely agree with what Karen has said. Underneath this all, there is not even a grudging respect for multilateralism, because there's so much now that's hitting us. It's very interesting how deep and quiet thinkers are considering not only the impact of these zoonotic pandemics, things that go from animals to humans, of which there are many, many now, but the combination with movements of people, with demography, with migration, and of course, environmental change summed up in the basket of climate change. Now, it seems as if I've drifted a long way from the purpose and nature and the evolution of NATO. No, I do think we're at a inflection point. And I think that this is the world that NATO, because it is such a successful umbrella organization, will have to move into. And I think there's very good signs that it is.
I think both of your opening addresses have really emphasized that there is so much at stake here. And, you know, the NATO alliance is still so important for Western security. But obviously, you know, President Trump is not the only critic of NATO. And on the other side of the Atlantic, we've had President Macron, who has emerged as a critic of NATO's strategic vision. And he argued late last year that Russia should be brought into a broader NATO, one which is directed towards fighting Islamic extremism in particular. But Karen, can Russia really be brought in from the cold? And is this more rhetoric than substance?
You know, it's a very good question, because I think that our Western countries have made some flawed assumptions over the years about both Russia and China. I think we assumed with both, the more you engage, the more they'll become like us. Now, with the U.S. and China, that started with Nixon back in the 60s, and that policy of engagement has only really been challenged by President Trump. Now, you may or may not agree with the way he's challenging it, but it's true that that policy has not worked. With Russia, it's the exact same thing. I think we thought, well, there was a short period, heady period after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We can all come together and solve all the world's problems together. And then, of course, we quickly realized, once we saw Putin in action, that, you know, he had a very different view of international order and disorder, and he was not remotely interested in joining the Western club. This doesn't mean that both countries can't become partners in some ways. We just need to be much more nuanced about it and probably more realistic about it.
And Robert, you've written recently about Putin. You've said that actually not everything is as it seems, and he is not as powerful necessarily as he might appear. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
I think that somewhere in the dark wee hours of the morning that he must realize that he must be very careful about what he wishes for. Russia, my point is, technically, is overcommitted. It is absolutely clear it's getting stuck in Syria, likewise in Libya, and it's trying to take a desperately minimalist approach. Basically, it doesn't want to put boots on the ground. It could put boots for hire on the ground in the shape of mercenary corps belonging to the Wagner Corporation, but they know that they can't go too far. Even the fact, just to give a quick illustration, of sending 14 MiG-29s into the Libyan desert, how long can they keep them there? Because they have to have, because the conditions are so harsh, rotating ground crews. So there is this business of now you see me, now you don't, this probe, disruptive policy, but it comes at quite a cost. He really does need Putin, for example, Turkey, to keep him, to get him out of trouble, to get him what he wants in Syria, which is namely two or three East Mediterranean bases. But the thing that is so obscure about Putin is what is going on in deep Russia itself. And I think that that's where COVID may well have an impact, either as a cause or a catalyst, where the regions we know are getting restive. And there have been terrible outbreaks, particularly in parts of the North Caucasus, where if he is not seen to be the man in charge, that's the thing that worries him, that he's got a pact which comes from his old Cold War KGB background. You know, it's part of a similar cynicism that I pretend to be a Democrat, but you like having a strong leader. And if he plays around too much because of the declining population, because of the declining price of oil, that, you know, the now you see me, now you don't game will not work where he needs it to work most, which is in Russia itself.
Can I just jump in, Jack, on that? Because I think Robert would agree with me. I mean, it is true that Russia has overextended itself, but people have been saying that about Russia for some time. I remember in September 2015, when they went into Syria, and the same sort of thing. They were all over the place. And I remember even Gulf states were saying back then, you know, even Muslims who drink are going to go for jihad against the Russians. You have this Christian Orthodox country in a Muslim, you know, in basically using military weapons, et cetera, in a Muslim country. And yet it didn't happen. And, you know, in many ways, Putin is quite clever because he's managed to punch above his weight in so many ways by using all sorts of hybrid asymmetric tools, many of which are online. And so, yes, he is overextending himself, and maybe COVID might bring him down, but it's a little bit like that conversation we always have about President Trump. Oh my God, this time, this time is really, and I just wonder if you agree with me on that, because it is quite interesting watching him. He has been a very clever tactical politician for a number of years now, and from his perspective, highly successful.
He doesn't overcommit himself, I agree. Having said that they look overextended, that, you know, that things aren't going forward in either Libya or Syria, yet he's been very clever with the Astana process of this group that's meeting in Astana, where he's got Turkey, Iran, and Russia talking together. And boy, they're the deliverers. They're the external powers that really matter in Syria. But I was struck by the US negotiator at the START talks, Billingsley, where he had come back from Vienna, where Russia and America had hoped that China would join in START renewal, which is very, very serious. And one of the things that Marshall Billingsley reported to the briefing, which I found absolutely striking, was how nervous Russia was. And Russia is reaching directly to Trump saying, for goodness sake, can't you get the Chinese on board? Because they're developing, they're ramping up their ballistic weapons program. Lot Nor now is 24/7. It's three shifts a day. They're still way behind on ballistic warheads. But Russians have been saying to the Americans, look, they're going to get there. And what do we do it? Because what I suspect the subtext was this, that we, like you, are finding it very hard to read Xi Jinping at the moment. Part of the package of NATO, and again why NATO is so important because of what it offers, is that it is a terrible mess as to what has happened between Trump and Putin in terms of arms reduction talks. The Americans, with some justification, are furious about the ditching of the INF because they say whatever we've said about it, the Russians have been building potent intermediate nuclear missile systems, the sea-based Sizzler, so-called, and now the land-based version, which has been operational for 3 years. This is really worrying, the international community, and rightly on this. It's as if, you know, with COVID and then with Daesh, ISIS, and with terrorism, we forgot about the balance of power and the need for nuclear weapons reduction. It is very important because there is always a tendency, there's a centrifugal tendency of the world to go nuclear. And Karen knows better than I, these undeclared groups, these undeclared nations that are really interested, because they are being sold the idea that you can have a nuclear weapon and get away with it. And you may even be able to go in for tactical first use. Think of a situation like Yemen. Think, supposing Saudi or Egypt had tactical nukes. And you can imagine what comes with the next. And again, that's why there is justifiable concern about Iran.
So is there a sense in which this very primal concern about, this very existential concern about nuclear capabilities could provide the basis for detente between Russia and the West, and in particular concern about China developing nuclear weapons capabilities?
Yes, I do think so, because I again agree with Karen, and she's been right in the middle of this in the Obama administration, is that there are very capable, intelligent people capable of talking to each other about this. And I think that this is what we forget. I speak against my own trade in this. I am very worried about the decline of reporting in mainstream metropolitan and cosmopolitan media. It is too much comment, the inverse ratio to forensic reporting from the ground. So we're not looking at the case histories of these things. But with NATO, it's not just, and I'm trying desperately not to be cute about this. With NATO, it isn't just an existential question, Jack, that you've raised. You have raised very rightly, implicit in your question, a teleological question, the purpose, where you go forward, teleology. Back to Aristotle with that. And I think that that's where NATO mustn't forget its old context and credentials and skills, but must move into this new area and new era, which it has done so successfully in the past. As the Cold War was winding down, it was so good with programs like Partnership for Peace. Now, what NATO will have to think about is how it moves out of area, which it has done almost by stealth in the global war against terror, because there was a global concept of the need to fight violent extremism. But there is now a global requirement from healthcare and sanitation. And there are things like that that we'll have to consider. And I don't want to make that look like or sound like airy persiflage, because you have got to think, even in the original core NATO North Atlantic area, from the Urals to the Atlantic, you've got to consider Africa and African stability, because it is going to be a determinant of what NATO thinks about itself existentially and teleologically.
One country which was mentioned earlier was Turkey. And Karen, I wanted to ask you about Turkey and Trump. Obviously, one of the things which has been in the news for the last few years is the sort of hotline that President Erdogan has with President Trump in the White House. And yet, President Erdogan is also building a defensive detente with Russia, and Russia has become more involved in Turkish energy markets. And yet Turkey is still a member of NATO. So what should be done here and what can be done?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the problem with the Trump presidency, is that he has no foreign policy and no strategies for dealing with any of these major challenges. Turkey is too important to let go, and they really should be coming up with, as complicated as it is, I think Robert, as Robert was saying earlier, we do have these leaders with similarities in the way that they approach politics, and they're both populist leaders, Erdogan and Trump. But Turkey is too important to let it slide eastward. It still needs to remain in the Western camp, in the NATO camp. And it's been incredibly important if you look at Syria. I mean, a lot of the response in Syria could not have been done without access through Turkey over the years. So we're not going to get a strategy out of this administration. We've seen that already. And 4 more years of it, it just means, as I mentioned earlier, means more atomization. And then other countries will just come up with coping mechanisms and ways of managing it. So whether that means NATO will be pushed ahead by Germany, by France, by Britain, and America may or may not participate. But certainly we need to have strategies globally to deal with some of these challenges, whether it's what to do about China or Russia or future pandemics or future major crises or many other things, many other conflicts. I mean, we have not resolved any of these crises that were here even before Trump got elected. He's not done one thing for any of them. And he won't, because he is not capable of developing and implementing a strategy from start to finish. He's just not capable, and he's not interested. And so we seem to be floating along, and then this pandemic comes along and it just gets thrown over an already complicated international system and adds an enormous layer of complexity and uncertainty to the international situation.
And turning to President Trump's challenger in November, Joe Biden, do you think he'll have the sort of the energy and the vigor and the vision needed to sort of bring NATO back and to reinvigorate NATO after 4 years of damage and in which it has been undermined?
Yeah, I mean, look, Biden on his own won't do that, but Biden will work very hard to rebuild alliances. And it won't be that easy. And there's no such thing as a reset. And the world has moved on. It's just a different place than it was with the sole superpower. America is now sharing power in a much more complex international environment. And I think many countries will, in any event, even if Biden wins, will be working very hard to build up their own, strengthen their own systems, because they may say, well, okay, Trump is gone, but what's to prevent a future Trump from getting elected in America again? So we can't really trust America in the way that we used to. So I do think countries are going to be thinking very differently about their future going forward, countries in the Western camp in particular. So Biden, look, he has as much energy as is needed. He'll have a good team around him. I mean, he's only 2 or 3 years older than Donald Trump, so I'm not sure. They're both in their late 70s, so I'm not entirely sure that fully matters, because I think Biden will bring in a team that has a lot of experience and that will actually know what a strategy is and how to implement it. And they believe in partnerships and they believe in European alliances and the importance of it. There won't be agreement on a number of issues. And I think you'll see countries pushing back much more on America than they ever had done prior to Trump, which I don't think is a bad thing. I don't think the world is necessarily safer with one country telling everyone else what to do. I think America needs to get much better at listening going forward.
Yes, and I think as President Reagan quipped, age definitely won't be an issue in this campaign.
Well, with him it was, unfortunately.
Yes, he used to nap in the Oval Office every afternoon, apparently, in his second term. So let's pivot away from specific personalities and local problems now and turn more towards general security frameworks and how we think about security and defence after the coronavirus pandemic. The current crisis has perhaps seen the United States on the geopolitical back foot at times. So I wanted to ask both of you, what sort of coalitions outside of NATO does the US need to be building now and where? Will the coronavirus crisis strengthen the case for the Trans-Pacific Alliance as a counterweight to an assertive China?
Yeah, back to NATO and Turkey involving this. I think that NATO has to see itself as a cog in a whole system of alliances. I'm impressed, for example, in the way that the Mediterranean powers are getting themselves together. That Greece and Italy, and funny enough, they found a way of getting Arabs to talk to Israel because on energy and security, environmental security, it's absolutely vital. And I think, by the way, science is going to be a great coalition maker. I think the people are really interested. Scientists do cooperate, and that's going to be a huge thing. But back to your specific point about Southeast Asia and the South China Sea and the Pacific and so on. Yeah, you can see exactly what is happening, that alliances are going to emerge. And I think that this is where, you know, Xi Jinping actually understands that he's not quite going to get it all his own way, because there is a formidable alliance developing with the US, Japan, South Korea. And one of the things that he has contrived to do with the confrontation in the high Himalayas, in Ladakh and so on, and all that going on, India is definitely moving towards whatever we might loosely term as the West. So you've got India, South Korea, you've got Japan and Australia, which is with successive foreign ministers, particularly Kevin Rudd in his design of their strategic position, has a very clear idea of what a lower order or a middle order medium power does. And I think that that's where it comes in. And I think that there is a lot of really sensible thinking going on in the United States. No, they don't want to do it alone. This is why America first is a siege mentality, which in the end gets you nowhere, because it's very interesting if you hear you get Trump, but on COVID-19, who has been the voice of America for so much of the international world? Anthony Fauci, or even the Gates family and the Gates Foundation. I think this is the way where we're going in the future. I hope, of course, but I do think there's something in the NATO ethos which says, let's pool our resources. And it's a thing where Macron, to go back to an earlier reply, was snappy. He was being smart. He was being cute. He was doing his Napoleonist grandstanding, probably to very poor effect, when he said that NATO was brain dead. Because certainly a lot of what NATO does in Europe cannot be replaced by the EU. I don't know whether Karen would agree, but I've seen the European Union Defence Entity, the European Defence Agreement, blossom, then shrink, and then go off. It cannot be a replacement. It must be a complement or a supplement. And I think that this is where we are going. And I think that this is where I agree. The focus will be for the US in the Pacific and not in Europe and the North Atlantic. That's where, sadly, Britain is so badly falling down at the moment. Because, honestly, the Americans would like Britain, France, Germany, and the very effective Nordics, who are very wealthy now and very capable and very smart, to take up the slack in managing wider European defence. But it is a system of systems, and I think that that's the way it goes forward. And being a smiling pessimist, I do see broadly some hope in this, and it is why certainly the way NATO has managed, by hook or by crook, and often with great prescience and often at the very last minute, and managed to adapt, is going to be the way forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just make two points on coalitions and what's happening globally. And I think two very critical lessons we've learned from this crisis is, one, how overly reliant we are on China. I think many countries were already thinking through that many European countries in particular were already coming to that conclusion before the crisis, because they were starting to see some of the more negative predatory behavior of China in Europe in terms of what they were purchasing and the types of industries they were taking over, a little bit of intellectual theft, all the same concerns that the US has had about China for some time. So many European countries are already moving back and getting concerned about when they say yes or say no to China. This will only reinforce that, because of course countries are seeing how overly reliant they are for supply chains, et cetera. So now many countries are pushing for what William Hague was calling deglobalization, whether it's critical industries, or bring that closer to home, or grow more of your own food closer to home, just being better prepared and building in redundancy. So there's that was already happening. And, you know, China, I don't know how China is going to come out of this crisis, because it did emerge, this thing started in China. And so they do bear some responsibility, even though they have not ever admitted that. But I think no matter what, they will be suffering economically just as much as everyone else. So they won't have as much money to be spreading around as they have been doing the last few years. So there's that aspect. And then the other issue we've learned from this crisis is how overly interdependent we all are, and we just can't do these things on our own. So what strikes me about this crisis, and I wrote a piece about it with my former boss, John Allen, is, you know, we spend all of our time talking about the Swedish model versus the Japanese model versus the French model, and we don't sit back and say, we all need to be in this together, because we're only as strong as the weakest link. And we can be dragged down just as easily if one country doesn't do the right things. And by the way, it's not just a health crisis. It spills over into so many other aspects of life. And so that's when I wrote a piece with my former boss. It was about the coalition that I was involved in that he led to counter ISIL. And that was pulled together very quickly. It had 80 or so countries. It dealt with soft and hard power issues. And by the way, it wasn't all led by the U.S. There were lots of other countries that were leading various groups on terror financing and communications, et cetera. And the U.S. nudged it along and kept it going. But as I was saying earlier, Trump just won't be able to do that. So none of that will happen as long as he is president.
So what seems to come out in what both of you are saying here is that we really need to broaden our idea of what security means in our current century. And Karen, you've written about what you call black sky hazards. I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit more about that and what that means.
Yeah, it's not my term. It comes from other organizations that really think about these, but basically these large scale global challenges that, like a pandemic, that set everyone back. And we are so wholly unprepared to manage these crises. Our systems, we don't have any international organization or any way really of coming together to think through how you anticipate and plan for and mitigate and manage these types of crises. And I think people just thought, well, it's just too difficult to contemplate, so let's not do it. But now I think when we are in the midst of one, we realize we have to rebuild, or we have to build a global architecture to do this. Now, what I wrote about was I was trying to argue with a colleague of mine that none of our institutions are currently set up to do this, and they all have their own flaws. The UN and others are great institutions for some things, but for an institution like this to work, you need to be able to ask the tough questions and push back. You can't always build consensus. Some of the challenges at the WHO are precisely because of that. And so you need something that can draw on the strengths of these multilaterals, but also draw on the strengths of the private sector and other sources so that we can respond better. So that's really what we were talking about.
Robert, where does this global perspective leave the nation state?
Well, I think it's around still, because there will be capitals, which is another thing. Because the other thing that we're beginning to see is the power of the megalopolis. Some of them are monsters that are almost beyond control, like Greater São Paulo and Rio, for example, Mexico City, bigger than your average, much bigger than your average Nordic state. But I think that you have to find where the critical mass of political and social effectiveness is. And that's why the nation state, it's premature to write it off. But what we have learned through the COVID crisis, not the COVID crisis alone, is the necessity of community engagement. The people, it was fashionable to say in the Trump election of 2016 to talk about the left behinds, the flyover states in America, the people who fall behind, beneath the cracks. But actually, in order to help, particularly in health and other crises, and it may well be in security and basic community law and order, you've got to do it at the community level. One of the great mistakes in the UK, which is absolutely transparent now, however much they try to conceal it, is that they over-centralize so much in the opening days of the COVID crisis. And this is where we're going to go for transformation. And transformation, I think, will come through organizations like the EU and NATO. But what they must realize in transformation, they've got an educational mission. They have got to grow new talent. They've got to grow new talents, new capabilities. And by that, you've got to engage young people, engage communities. It cannot just be hard power, hard power. Yeah, we've had wonderful Joe Nye who still keeps going. He talks about smart power and sharp power now. And this is where we're going. The building blocks will remain the same, but it's not a building block necessarily made by Lego. It's a group of building blocks made by a Rubik's Cube, and we haven't got the final solution, nor will we ever have. But this is the way that we are moving forward. And the education that I'm talking about has to be based on the three R's, which we have found so lacking in the crisis, particularly in Northern Europe and the United States. And it's resilience, redundancy built into your capacity. You've got to have it there, and risk aversion.
Do you have something to add there, Karen?
Look, I mean, it's complicated. There's a little bit of everything. There's a nation state, but you see cities coming together globally to solve problems. Civil society organizations are quite strong. You have some companies that are more powerful, like Amazon, than many states are. And then you have some charities like the Gates Foundation that's also incredibly powerful. So it's just, it's much more complex. The environment is much more complex, and you have to factor in the power of all of these various forces when you think about it. That's why I was saying earlier, the UN on its own isn't the right place to go, or NATO on its own to solve these problems. But it has to be a partnership of all of these. And to have partnerships, you need leadership. And that's what we're sorely lacking in globally right now, is leadership. We're not getting that really in any, I mean, there are only one or two countries that I can think of that have leaders that are really trying to promote change in a positive way and not pushing inward like you see in Brazil or you see in India or you see in many other countries that Robert mentioned earlier.
Which shows, you know, don't kick the institutions just because they've got weaknesses. And the criticism of the WHO, it is a flawed organization for all the reasons stated, but where would we be without it?
So just to wrap up, Robert has described himself as a smiling pessimist. And Karen, do you think that in a kind of counterintuitive way, this crisis will see networks of alliances between liberal democracies strengthened?
I hope so. I mean, I've always been a bit of an optimist, and I'm a believer that we can build back better and we can build back greener and all of those slogans that are being bandied about. But we do need the right people in charge. And I think there is a recognition now, even in America, that Donald Trump is not that right, not that leader to make those changes. But I'm not sure if that's happening in other countries like Russia and other places where we do need those changes. I mean, including in China. China is an incredibly complicated country. And in Russia. And China and Russia are both very powerful. And if we continue to have these very authoritarian leaders stay in power for years to come, it's going to make everyone's lives very difficult going forward. I mean, I think Robert also made an interesting point by bringing up India. I mean, don't forget, a third of the world's population live in India and China. And we all are worried about China, but we should be thinking a lot more about India. Now, I think there is always an assumption with both of those countries, though, that they will remain unitary states. Because they have been for so long, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we just have to plan for everything and think about every contingency because, you know, yes, okay, China's been around for thousands of years, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to remain in its current order or organization going forward for many years. It could, but, you know, it's really hard to say. And so I do think we need to be thinking a lot more about India and how to, you know, keep India on side going forward, because it's an incredibly important country.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how the Middle East as a concept, which was always a bit flaky, I think, geopolitically for geopoliticians, is fading before our eyes. And if you look at because of the way oil is going or not going, the address of the Gulf countries, for example, quite right, is towards Asia. Some no longer described as the Middle East, but as Western or Southwestern Asia. And I agree that things will change.
That's a good note to end on. Karen and Robert, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Next episode, I'll be joined by Douglas Alexander and Maggie Pagano to talk about creative destruction and rebuilding the world economy.